and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, Dall Sheep on the Decline, understanding sheep population dynamics with Alaska Department of Fish and Game research biologist Dr. Tom Loheis. Hosted by the Alaska Zoo, his presentation was recorded at a Wildlife Wednesday lecture on January 9th.
So tonight we have Tom Loheis here. He is going to be talking on Dall Sheep. And a quick bio on Tom. He grew up in Western Wyoming and returned to the state to complete his master's and PhD work at the University of Wyoming after an undergraduate degree in biology at Northwestern University in Chicago. His formal education is based in physiology and nutritional ecology rather than traditional wildlife research methods, but it was his love for mountaineering and wild places that allowed him to create and design research projects that he describes as taking the laboratory to the animal, often working in winter and or alpine environments. During the course of his PhD work, he crawled in over 80 bear dens, awesome, in Wyoming and Colorado to investigate the effects of hibernation on muscle physiology and to try and understand why bears don't experience traditional muscle atrophy. He came to Alaska in 2003 as the director of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's Kenai Moose Research Center, and spent 2003 to 2008 investigating the nutritional requirements of pregnancy in cow moose. In 2008, he was hired as the species specialist for Dall Sheep of South Central Alaska and started the research that he'll be talking about this evening in early 2009. So welcome, Tom.
Thanks, Marla. Before I get going, there's a couple of things that I'd like to mention. First off, I get the credit for this, but this is very much a collaborative effort. There's a very strong team of wildlife biologists and technicians and aviation support folks that have come together to put this project together, and everybody's given very generously of their time and effort and made some substantial intellectual and physical contributions. So I get to talk about it, but that in no way diminishes the contributions of a number of people that I'll acknowledge by name, but don't think for a minute that this is all mine. So to get rolling here, there's also a couple of caveats that I'd like to point out. I'll be speaking about 4 years of research from one of two study areas, that up in Game Management 13D, and I'll talk about that, where that is in just a bit, but only 9 months of another study that we started in March. All the work and all of the data that I'm going to present tonight should be considered preliminary. We don't have the analyses complete. It's also important to remember that we don't really want to draw major comparisons between the two study areas. We've got almost 4 years of work in one and just less than a year in another, so those data sets are not complete. So the story is still very much work in progress. With that in mind, I'm going to talk about the first study up in Game Management Unit 13D. We picked that study area for one reason and one reason alone. Bob Tobey, the area biologist in Glen Allen at that time, had a very long and very comprehensive population census, and he tracked that for several years up there. We had a documented decline in the sheep population of almost 50% within the study area. We'd seen sheep numbers drop from a high of 650 to 750 all the way through the 1980s to a fairly marked low, between 300 and 400 animals when the population bottomed out in 2007-2008. We also knew that the decline in the population was very similar in both the ram and the ewe component. So that suggested to us that there was something else going on up there other than hunting. We weren't just shooting all the rams. If that would have been the case, we'd have seen a decline in the ram component. The ewe population might have been more stable. But we didn't see that. We saw both groups following the same trajectory. It's also important to remember that when we started this project in 2009, we didn't have any idea what was going on with sheep in South Central Alaska. We were flying summer surveys. We'd go out and we'd count, 30 lambs per 100 ewes, but we really didn't know what that meant. We didn't know how we got there. For example, maybe all 100 ewes gave birth and 70 of those lambs were eaten, or maybe the nutritional condition in those animals was so bad that only a third of our ewes were pregnant and all the lambs were surviving. So we knew what we were getting, but we didn't really know how we were getting there. So we decided that we were going to establish this project to give us a baseline demographic picture, basically try to identify and enumerate the the factors that are driving sheep population trends here in South Central. And we hadn't had collars on animals before to any extent. There'd been a little bit of isolated effort in Chugach State Park, but nothing on a large experimental scale. So with that in mind, we thought we'd target our four big players: pregnancy, rates of recruitment, how many animals are joining the population every year, rates and causes of mortality in our productive segment of the population, our lambs, and in our ewes, the productive segment of the population, and in our lambs, and then try to get a handle on the disease presence and prevalence in that population. This is Game Management Unit 13D, the highway. The Glen Highway, from Palmer to Glen Allen runs along the northern border of the study area. Glen Allen is here. Sheep Mountain Lodge is right here. The study area is bounded on the far west end by the Matanuska Glacier, and on the far east by the Taslina Glacier, on the south side by the ice cap, and on the north by the Matanuska River lowlands. We chose the study area and the boundaries in an attempt to keep animals in the study area. We wanted everything to be fairly discrete. We also had our real solid population estimate, and we didn't want animals leaving the study area, so we thought that the big ice would tend to keep them in. The other advantage is that we have Mike Meekins Airstrip, Meekins Roadhouse, right here at the northwestern corner. So at least by Alaska standards, the logistics are shockingly easy. This is very much a front country operation. We can drive a truck right to the airstrip and then stay in Mike's cabin and watch movies on the big screen at night, prepping for captures. So we've got don't for a minute think we're living in tents. It's pretty good living. So that's 13D. Game Management Unit 14C is a little bit closer to home, right here up above town. We've had a real cyclic sheep population in this area, going from lows of 900 to 1100 in the early 1960s, 70s, and 80s, peaked around 2200 sheep, late 80s through early 2000, and then has dropped again by about half in the last several years. Interestingly enough, we've seen this population start to rebound just slightly over the last 2 years. We've gone from a low of about 900 to a high of 1150 on the last census, which was July 2011. Again, the changes in this population are similar in the ram and the ewe components. Again, this is a new study. This is just 9 months old. And with this project, we went in trying to ask a couple slightly different questions. They're similar, but we targeted them a little bit differently. First off, are the driving factors similar between the two study areas? And second, can we generalize? Can we apply this data over a broad scale over South Central Alaska? Secondarily, we collared a small group of juvenile rams, half to three-quarter curl rams, to try to get a little bit better handle on rates and causes of mortality and some movement patterns in our juvenile rams, start learning a little bit more about the ram component of the population. That's a side project. I won't talk much more about it other than to say we did it. Study area in 14C, bounded on the north by Pioneer Peak and Goat Creek, Eklutna, Peters Creek, Eagle River, and Ship Creek, and we stopped the study area on the south end. Everything that's draining into Ship from the south. This was primarily done for two reasons: just to keep our animals in a nice, discreet little area that we can fly and cover in a reasonable amount of time from a super cub, and secondarily to keep collared animals from showing up on popular wildlife viewing areas along Turnagain Arm. So now that you know where we're working, I'll tell you a little bit about the questions we're asking. We know from work in bighorn sheep and other thinhorn populations in the Brooks Range and the Alaska Range, that weather, late spring heavy snows, and late season ice formation can influence sheep populations. We know that this kind of a weather pattern can wipe out lamb crops. We know from Steve Arthur, who's my counterpart, he's a sheep biologist out of our Fairbanks office, that in the Alaska Range at least, 90% of the lamb mortality that Steve recorded was due to predation. Coyotes and eagles were the major players in that study. It was a four-year project that completed in 2002, 2003. Interestingly enough, all of the adult mortality that Steve recorded, every single adult that died on that project was killed by a predator. Wolves, bears, and wolverines were the players there. This is something that, keep in mind, we ended up coming up with some very different data in South Central. I'll talk more about that when we get there, but keep in mind these numbers. Steve's project showed lamb survival to 1 year pretty low at 26%, with a relatively high annual adult survival rate of about 85%. The story is, it's pretty tough being a lamb, but if you can make it to adulthood, you've pretty much got it made. So similarly, a little bit of work from the lower 48 showed that habitat and nutrition both play a huge, huge role in terms of pregnancy rates. Bighorn sheep with mineral deficiencies often show low pregnancy rates, and poor habitat conditions can decrease lamb production as well. Disease is another factor that we needed to get some information on. Remember, we're just creating baseline information about sheep in South Central at this point. We don't know anything about what's driving sheep populations. So we wanted to get a real handle on whether pneumonia was present, as well as several other major viral players that can have substantial effects. If you're a sheep person, if you've followed the sheep world news, you know that some of the lower 48 states are having tremendous effect of disease outbreaks. They're losing 80-90% of bighorn sheep herds to pneumonia. So because we'd had some reports of dead sheep on the ground in both our study areas, we wanted to make sure we're not ruling that out as part of a part of what was creating our sheep population decline. We start our project year with adult captures in March and early April. I'll tell you a little bit about this. We've maintained a sample of about 40 animals collared and checked every year in our 13D project area. Every time we handle these animals, we fit them with a VHF radio collar, take a blood and a fecal sample, a nasal and pharyngeal swabs for a disease screen. We run a body condition assessment, and we use some of the blood for a pregnancy test. We'll weigh them if we get a chance, but as you might guess, sheep country isn't necessarily conducive to putting an animal on a scale. Our 14C project is similar. We've got 35. We started the project in March of 2012 and put 35 radio collars on adult ewes and 19 smaller rams to get our project off and running. Again, the same workup, except that on a subset of these animals, we substituted GPS collars to get some fine scale movement data. I'm going to take a break in the talk here, close down this PowerPoint window, and show you a little bit of capture video. before I do that, I want to point out that it looks like there's a lot of stuff happening really fast when we capture animals, and to a certain extent that's true. But I also want you to keep in mind a couple things. This is an extremely stressful event for the animal, so we're doing our absolute level best to make it as fast and as efficient and as stressless as possible. To that end, we've got a couple of protocols in place to try to limit any additional stress to these animals from the handling. First off is we won't chase an animal for more than 3 minutes from the helicopter. As long as that animal is moving in response to the helicopter, the clock is ticking. The minute that animal hears the helicopter and takes its first step, we start the clock. We've got 3 minutes to get that animal netted before we'll abandon the chase. Once the net's on that animal, we give ourselves 17 more minutes for a total of 20-minute handling time. once we have the animal restrained, we insert a thermometer and continuously monitor its core temperature. The two biggest predictors of capture mortality in sheep or any other ungulate are chase time and body temperature. So by minimizing our chase time and monitoring body temp, we've managed to keep our capture mortality extremely, extremely low. We've worked hard to do that, and we're proud of that record. But a couple other things to think about. As we're catching these guys, we're never really netting them on a dead run. We're waiting for that animal to hit a flat spot, to turn uphill, something, so when it's stopped rather violently, the stress is minimized. So when you're watching this, think about what that animal is doing in the instant that net is fired. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as soon as the video's over.
To watch the video of Tom and his team netting doll sheep from a helicopter, go to alaskapublic.org.
And I brought the net gun along just for a little bit of show and tell. This is essentially a bolt-action hunting rifle. I removed the bolt, sawed off about 4 inches in front of the firing pin with a manifold welded to it. It fires a .308 caliber blank. The gas from the blank goes out into the manifold, these four arms, and each corner of this 10-foot by 10-foot Spectra nylon net is attached to a weight with an O-ring. So the gas blows the weights out, and they carry the net along with it. Slow motion view of the net deployment. There's a sheep down there at the bottom of the avalanche chute. Once the animal's in the net, this is my graduate student, Brianne Winter. We blindfold and hobble the animal, want to point out at this juncture, we don't actually use immobilizing chemicals on these animals. There's some very serious long-term effects of using drugs. They're very bad on animals' thermoregulatory capacity, and it affects gut motility. The way that food is processed in the intestine is compromised by the drug. The other issue, of course, working in a mountainous environment, is that there's what we call an induction time. There's about a 3 to 5 minute lag before that drug takes effect. So with the net gun, we're able to restrain that animal in a location that we want. With a dart and a drug, we'd have a several minute induction time during which that animal could do something that we don't want it to do, like wander off a cliff. You notice Bree's got one hobble on here on the upside legs, and he's in the process of hobbling that used downside. And they actually respond really well to secure restraint and a blindfold. We carry drugs, but probably don't have to use them in one in 25 cases. Animals fitted with a radio collar, and we get a quick blood sample. And then at the end of the handling, they're administered a shot of antibiotic to counteract any immunocompromisation that might have been an effect of the handling. This is wildlife tech Sean Conway out of our Glen Allen office. And then 17 minutes-ish later, the animal's released. A little bit of data from our 13D project. Now that we've got the handling, this is some of the data we've collected. Body condition on our game management unit 13DUs was really, really poor. They're extremely skinny, even for ungulates in late winter. These animals were scored as a 1 to 2 on a 0 to 5 scale, with 0 being darn near dead and 5 being butterball. To give you an idea, none of these animals we handled in any year of the project had any subcutaneous fat present. You could run your hands down the spine of this animal from all the way from the neck, feel that nuchal ligament all the way down its spine, feeling every single bony process on the vertebra, down its withers, across its pelvis, feel its tailbone, ilium and ischium, and there's between a half to a centimeter between the spine and the underlying muscle bed. So these animals have really wasted away by late winter. Additionally, that nuchal ligament, if you've ever field dressed an animal, you know there's that big long ligament that runs from the shoulders all the way up the back of the head. These guys are so skinny, you can actually pinch that ligament and your fingers will meet on the neck. underneath that ligament, you can feel your fingers touching as you run your hands down this animal. Now this is important because we're not seeing that in interior and Brooks range sheep. Again, Steve Arthur, my counterpart in the Fairbanks office, says that every animal he handles carries sub-Q fat and they're well muscled. So it's a real direct contrast between what we're seeing in South Central and what they're getting in the interior and the Brooks. This was our second major red flag. We had some real skinny sheep that set off some bells. And when we got our pregnancy rate data back, we got another set of red flags. Our first year's data set gave us a pregnancy rate of 62%. This might not seem like it's all that bad, but when you look at most ungulate populations, they're typically around 85 to as high as 100%. Comparison with some interior sheep, Steve Arthur, again, 4 years of work in the Alaska range, basically had 85 to 95% pregnancy, except for one bad year at 79%. Mari Wood, who's a colleague of mine that works on Stone's sheep in British Columbia, just completed a 5-year project, 45 to 50 ewes collared for 5 years, and 100% pregnancy rate, all those animals, for the entire scope of the project. So that puts this into a little bit of perspective. We're not really seeing the lambs hit the ground at the rate that other sheep populations are. That trend held through most of the project. We had a higher pregnancy rate in 2010, but then the last couple of years, it's dropped off again. The 2012 pregnancy rate was especially surprising. 21% of our mature ewes, that's asterisked because that's the lowest pregnancy rate I've ever found a record of in an ungulate population. So we're setting records, probably not the records we want to set, but it's something to keep in mind. I suspect that was related to the extremely bad winter we had last year. We'll collect some more data on that this year, and with a little bit of luck, we'll see a rebound, but I suspect that one was weather related. Our disease work was fairly benign. We ran samples from 37 adult ewes. 28 of the 37 tested positive for one of two family members that are known to of bacteria that are known to cause respiratory disease, pneumonia, in sheep in the lower 48. The whole disease model is a fairly complex thing, and there's far, far better minds than mine working on it at the moment. But suffice to say, you've got to have both players, you've got to have both families of bacteria to create a massive 80-90% population die-off. We've only documented one, so that's kind of where we are right now. Didn't turn up any viral disease in our northern study area, so that was a bit reassuring. 14C, again, these are preliminary data points just based on 1 year. I'm just showing the map to get you to switch gears with me and realize we're talking about a different study area. Again, body condition in 14C was strikingly poor. Interestingly enough, these animals were in slightly better shape than in 13D. And the animals that we managed to weigh, just the small number of animals, were actually heavier by 10 to 12%. Our ewes in 13D are 110 to 120 pounds. The 14C animals are 125 to 135, and you can actually feel it when you grab them. You get out of the helicopter to net them and restrain them, and they're fighting a little bit harder, and they're definitely a more robust animal. Still, though, we're not seeing any sub-Q fat in these guys. They're skinny. All the bony structures of the neck, spine, withers, and pelvis are still evident. We're not able to measure quite as much distance between the backstrap, the longissimus dorsi muscle, and the top of the spine as we could in our 13D critters, but they're still awful skinny. And just again, point out, this is in direct contrast to our Brooks and Alaska range sheep. We also had a very low pregnancy rate at 43%. That's another issue that surfaced. And again, just 1 year of data. We'll have to finish the project up and see what that shows us. real similar results in terms of disease. A little bit of one of the two families, the less virulent of the two. I'll talk more about this in a second. A couple of positives on some obscure viral players that probably don't have a real big population level effect. Monitoring these animals. After we get the collars on, what do we do with them? Well, lots of super cub time. These animals are flown about twice a month, weather and daylight permitting. Every time we go up, we check these animals, record a location, make sure they're alive. The adult collars, and I'll pass this around. This is just a VHF radio collar. Sound like this, as long as the animal's alive. So we hear that 60 beats a minute. That's a good thing. That animal's alive, we can follow it to the animal. Collar goes into mortality mode if the animal hasn't moved in 4 hours on the adults, 1 hour on the lamb collar, and then it kicks up to 90 beats a minute. The fast signal indicates that animal hasn't moved. So when we get that, we get in there as quickly as possible and try to diagnose the cause of mortality. Usually we bring a helicopter in and we're able to land fairly close. In a lot of cases, it's a fairly easy diagnosis. If you look close, you can see a set of ewe horns right here and some white hair. This was a wolf kill, and once we picked up the collar, that was confirmed, the collar from that same animal. So that's a fairly obvious one. In other cases, they're equally obvious, but not as easy to get. this particular slide, this animal was killed in March. This photo was shot in May. We dug for about 2.5 hours and gave up. Finally went back in September and recovered the collar. I have no idea how far down it was, but it was way, way, way down in the debris pile. in some other cases, this is what we find, and it's nowhere near as easy to diagnose. So fortunately, we've got helicopters and road access, and we're able to get that carcass to Dr. Kathy Burek. She's a veterinary pathologist who works in Eagle River. She's awesome. She's board certified, and she does all the necropsy work for the Alaska Sea Life Center and all the endangered species work. So point is, it's not some guy, me, out there just hacking and slashing with a scalpel saying, oh yeah, something killed it. This is high-end veterinary work, and we're pretty confident that when she does the necropsy, we can get to the cause of death. Most of the time, it turns out it's pneumonia in a case like that. Overall, ewe mortality is on the project. Remember, we've had 40 animals collared a year for 4 years. We've lost a total of 16 adults. Our biggest player, avalanches, late winter typically, followed by pneumonia. Little bit of predation, wolverines, two animals lost to non-predation causes. again, we were able to recover the carcass and the rotted carcass had rotted to the point that we couldn't get good data from the necropsy. Just one of those situations with doing field work. A couple of animals we lost, we were unable to determine the cause. Both these animals were in a real high avalanche danger situation, and I'm sorry, I just wasn't willing to get out of the helicopter and get slid for a dead sheep. wolf predation, uterine infection, and then lost one ewe last winter to old age. Her teeth were gone, and she'd was showing signs of pneumonia as well as malnutrition, but given that she was 17, I think we can chalk that one up to old age. This is a graphic look at that same data. Basically, what this slide shows you is if you're a sheep and you make it to adulthood, you've pretty well got it nailed. 91% of our animals survive to make it to the next year. If you expand that mortality, that little slice of the pie that talks about mortality, this is what you see. Avalanches are our biggest player, followed very closely by pneumonia. Wolverines take a little bit, and then wolves and age and a complicated pregnancy took the remainder. As far as 14C goes, we're just early on in the project. We've only had one animal lost, but that was to an avalanche. A soft snow slough took her off a ridge in Peters Creek last April. Moving on to, you can just set that down, thanks. Moving on to lamb work, we're catching neonate lambs in May and June. And I put this slide up for one reason. This is a lamb that we capture. If you look closely, that lamb's wearing one of our radio collars. And we'll grab the lamb, work it up. The workup takes about 2 minutes, 3 minutes. We release it, and most of the time the ewe has been 40 to 60 meters away watching us. She'll come right back in and pick up that lamb. So it's very reassuring for us when we see this. Again, I'll take a pause here, show you another little video clip. A few of you might know Corey Stantorf. I'll give Corey the credit for the video, and this is a little bit of video footage that he shot during some lamb captures last May.
To watch the video of Tom's team chasing down a newborn doll sheep in the Chugach Mountains, go to alaskapublic.org.
These are pretty neat little radio collars. They're made by a company in California, in Arizona called Telonix. They are stretchy. Think of an ACE bandage with a radio unit riveted to it, and then they're bar tacked. This is a new one that has not been deployed. If you look closely here, you've got a couple little Z's in the stitching, and the stitching is actually a UV-sensitive thread. So as the sunlight hits the hits the collar, the thread degrades, and as the animal grows, the bar tacks pop out and it expands. And ultimately, after 12 to 18 months, the stitching totally comes undone. This is a collar that perfectly served its purpose and fell off the animal just to ensure that animal didn't wear the collar into eternity. And just pass that around. So we check these guys a little bit more closely than we check the adults. Lambing seems to last for about a month. There's no real peak. The median date, that middle point where half the lambs are born before and half the lambs are born after, is May 27. But they're scattered all the way through. We'll have lambs on the ground as early as the 11th of May. I've seen newborn lambs as late as the 12th or 13th of June. So we're out for a month. We fly our animals every day. When we get a lamb, we'll bring the helicopter in and try to capture it. We'll maintain that daily schedule through the 15th. And after the 15th of June to the 1st of July, we'll fly those animals twice a week, just looking for mortality. July 1st through the beginning of hunting season, we ramp it back a little bit further to once a week. We won't fly during hunting season. And then after the 1st of October, we'll check animals on the same schedule as the adults, twice a month or so. Again, when a mortality is detected, we'll get in there as quickly as possible. We've done pretty well on sample size over the last 4 years. 19 to 26 lambs each of the first 3 years, and then 14 last year, just as a function of that real low pregnancy rate. Lamb survival is totally and completely variable, totally across the board. Our first year, we had 42% lamb survival. We were pretty much turned in handsprings. We're like, well, we got a low pregnancy rate. We can live with it. Lots of these guys are surviving. 2010, 2011, story changed a little bit. I'll tell you what happened and why here in the next couple of slides. Looking specifically at 2009, we had some early mortality from eagles, brown bears, and an unknown predator. There's a break there. Look at the time scale. We have early mortality followed by a break. So we lose a lot of animals early on, 10 days, 2 weeks, first month old, starvation and drowning. on the non-predation side, case of pneumonia, and then there's a fairly substantial break between about a month and 6 to 7 months. Wolf predation showed up 9 months, wintertime malnutrition, and avalanche killed some that first winter. 2010 was similar, a couple of eagle kills early on. one of the lambs died in a fall, two drowned, one starved to death. The ewe failed to lactate, might have been a young ewe, might have had a case of mastitis, hard to say. And then one succumbed to pneumonia at about a month and a half. After that, we didn't see much in the way of mortality until we lost a couple lambs to a brown bear midwinter, wolverine predation late winter, and we had one where three different predators visited the site, as well as three animals killed in avalanches at 9, 10, and 11 months. But again, that pattern starts to show up. High mortality early on, we lose about half of our, we experience about half of our lamb loss the first month to 5 weeks of life. And then there's a break. We don't see it picking up again until later in the winter. 2011 was fairly similar. Added a black bear as a predator. Wolves made an appearance, but wolverines still were prevalent. Lost two animals in a rock slide. That was a new one. But avalanches and pneumonia continued to kill some lambs. And then unfortunately, late last winter, we lost three lambs that I had to chalk up in the unrecovered column. You might remember all that snow and the heavy wind slabs. Again, the avalanche conditions were so severe that we just couldn't get to the collars. Diagnosing mortalities in lambs is fairly straightforward. Nice thing about white animals is that blood shows up real well. Anytime a predator has visited a site, we chalk that up to a predation kill. And this is the most conservative approach. This isn't my invention, it's in the literature. But what we're trying to do is make sure that we don't underestimate the effects of predation. in most cases, we're able to get to our animals intact if they have not been killed by a predator. So we're confident that scavenging is, in most cases, not erroneously chalked up as predation. This was a pneumonia death. Each predator leaves a very characteristic signature. This is an eagle kill. You note that the spine, come on, spine's intact, long bones are intact. Occasionally eagles will open the skull and take the brains out, but this is a fairly characteristic eagle kill. You also get eagle poop and some feathers, as well as a fairly well-plucked carcass, just a different view of that same mortality. Brown bears will often leave a calling card and the skin, but all of the edible parts are gone. Wolverines will leave you the occasional long bone. If you look close, there's a jaw right there between the radio collar and the radio receiver. And other times the cause of death is again fairly straightforward. A little leg sticking out of a log jam there. Rock slide mortality. It's a pretty tough life the first year. I included this slide to show one thing. This is kind of wildlife biology 101. If you've ever had a wildlife class, you know what this means. This is a femur from a lamb that was born in May and died in early to mid-January. That strawberry jam colored bone marrow is highly indicative of starvation. That's just a definitive diagnosis of that animal starved to death, poor wintertime nutrition. So that's an easy diagnosis, although we had to go into the lab, into the necropsy to do it. If you look across the board over 3 years of work, and I'm not including our 2012 cohort just because we're only about halfway through the project year, and so we'd bias the overall result. If you look at the last 3 years from 13D, we've had a total of 66 lambs collared and included in the analysis. We've lost roughly a third to predation, a third to non-predation, and a fifth or so survived. Now, here's where it gets interesting. And I'm not trying to make anybody sick with this pinwheel, so I apologize if you get easily motion sick. The take-home message here is that green quarter of the pie or green fifth of the pie or those animals survived. But everything else is across the board. Eagle kills, brown bears, wolverines take about the same amount. Then you move on down to wolves, black bears, coyotes take a smattering apiece. You don't really get into another big player until avalanches, drownings, and pneumonia. But the point is here is there's no one factor responsible for all the lamb mortality. It's across the board. If you remember one of the earlier slides, this is where things differ very substantially from the Alaska range study that I talked about. Steve showed 90% of his lamb morts were due to predation, with coyotes and eagles being the two big players. And this is very, very different. So obviously it'd be difficult to institute any management action to benefit this sheep population. 14C, we're just in the initial stages. We've had 26, started the year with a very successful 26 lambs collared, lost a handful to eagles real early on, and then a coyote mortality, and one animal drowned. Again, don't make comparisons. We're only halfway through the project year, and we've got 1 year of data here as opposed to three that we're talking about in the other areas. So what does this all mean? Well, adult survival is pretty good. If you can make it through that first year as a lamb, your chances of doing that are about 20%, fairly slight. Maybe better if you're born in a low snow year. We'll see what this year brings. A very small fraction of our adult mortality, about 1/5, is due to predation. 80%, almost 80% due to non-predation causes. Again, 1/3 of our lambs are lost to predation and 1/3 to non-predation. Now, the low percentage of our total animals that are lost to predation and the broad distribution across predator species suggests to me very strongly that this population is not predation limited. We can pretty much rule out one of our four big players. The second thing, disease. The real low presence and real low prevalence of all the major wildlife diseases that we ran our tests for. We can also say, I think pretty confidently, at least in that study, that disease is not playing a population level effect. We do see some animals succumb to pneumonia, maybe as a result of additional stressors, hard winters, something like that. But I think it's a low enough isolated occurrence that we can confidently say that disease just isn't a major player. However, this is where things start to gel a little bit for me. Annual pregnancy rates in 3 of our 4 years, are much, much lower than observed in other populations. This appears to me to be really chronically low. We're going to run one more year on the project with this upcoming spring, but I think we can say that it's at least suggesting a nutrition, a habitat, or potentially a weather issue. With 13D slated to end after the 2013 project year, so we're going to spend one more year, try to get a little bit better handle on that nutritional side. There's some other analyses that I'm looking at long-term reproductive history on these individual animals. Remember, we're capturing each one of these animals every year for 4 to 5 years. So we're going to have a very detailed reproductive history, start to answer some of the questions as to whether they're getting pregnant every year or getting pregnant a year, taking a year off, getting pregnant a year, taking a year off, which would give us further information, give us further evidence, that we're looking at a nutritional issue. We're right at the tail end of a hair cycle, bottoming out up in 13D. So far, we haven't seen any prey shifting from lynx, coyotes, eagles, taking hares and shifting to lambs. Steve Arthur and Laura Prue in the Alaska Range did a very, very elegant piece of work documenting that when hare numbers decline, some of those middle-sized predators shift over to lambs. We haven't seen that. One more year will allow us to confirm that as the hare population is pretty much tanking up there. We do suspect that we're seeing maybe some weather effects. One of my theories at the moment, not really at the moment, the last several years, is that we're seeing a decrease in available winter nutrition due to some snow and ice formation. To that end, we're starting to use satellite imagery to determine whether current ice cover and snow cover is any different than it might have been 20, 30 years ago. And we're also starting to look at temperature records. We've deployed some temperature loggers in the study area. We're able to correlate temperatures in the study area with temperatures at remote weather stations at Sheep Mountain, at Taslina Airstrip, and we might be able to go back and document that we've had more Chinook events, which could potentially melt freeze events, create ice on winter habitat and limit these guys in terms of winter habitat. We're also looking at trace mineral levels, and again, that's ongoing. The 14C project was conceived as a 2-year study, slated to end in June 2014, and that's when Brianne will finish up her master's work. we may extend that depending on what we see and whether there's funding for it, but right now we're going to capture our ewes again this upcoming spring and maintain another sample of lambs. Hopefully that'll give us the data we need. We'll reevaluate that after the 13 project year. Basically, with the questions I'd like to answer there, are the demographics in 14C similar to other areas of the Chugach, other areas in South Central? Weather, predation, habitat, are those patterns conserved? Are they fairly consistent between study areas? Can we generalize across South Central, maybe get into the southern side of the Alaska Range, the Talkeetnas, or are we going to need to run some projects in those areas? And finally, I'll just kind of hint at this. Ideally, we'll be able to get a pretty good data set on some juvenile RAM movement, as well as dispersal and distribution, ultimately looking at survival rates and try to get a better handle on what's going on with the full curl harvest, what that really means for our sheep populations. I know that's a real hot topic right now among a lot of our sheep hunting public. So that's something that's coming down the pike. Well, that's probably 3 to 5, maybe 7 years out. Be happy to talk about that a little bit later. Hopefully when we have some data to talk about with it rather than just hypotheticals. With that in mind, I really need to acknowledge the following folks. These guys are amazing. It's wildlife technicians Mike Harrington, Kyle Smith, Corey Stantorf, and biologists Becky Schwanke, Tony Cavalock, Thomas McDonough, Chris Brockman, Sean Conway, graduate student Brianne Winter. Like I said, I couldn't have done this without these folks, and I get to talk about it, but the end result is as much theirs as it is mine. There's a scene in the Blues Brothers where Jake and Elwood are, man, we're putting the band back together. And the way I look at this is all I did was put the band together. We've had a lot of help from a lot of people, and I can't thank them enough. Additionally, aviation support, Mike Meekin and Matt Keller, Meekin's Air Service, Blue Ice Aviation, Mike Litson of Litson Guide Service out of Nikiski, Mark Shelton and David Rivers out of Fairbanks Quicksilver Air, and Tommy Levanger with Pollux Aviation. with that, I'll go ahead and close and be happy to take any questions that you've got. Thanks again for coming. We had a blast doing this. I'm excited to share it with you.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Alaska Department of Fish and Game research biologist Dr. Tom Lohuis. His talk on Dall Sheep on the Decline, Understanding Sheep Population Dynamics, was recorded at the Wildlife Wednesday lecture series hosted by the Alaska Zoo on January 9th. If you'd like to watch the two sheep capture videos Tom shared during his presentation, you can find them at alaskapublic.org. Following his talk, Tom responded to audience questions. First, he was asked, have you differentiated between eagle species identified as predators of Dall sheep?
At this point, we're assuming that all of our eagle mortality is golden eagles. We have not collected feathers, but given the number of goldens that we almost hit with the helicopter,
yeah.
As opposed to the number of balds,
yeah.
I never say never, but I'm fairly confident that, let's put it this way, most of the eagles we see in the project area are goldens.
Okay.
Occasionally we'll see a bald down low in the riparian, but my sense is that it's heavily biased towards goldens.
Is that true of 14C as well?
So far, yeah.
Okay.
But that's 1 year and just a little bit of flight data. So I won't hang my hat on it, but I'm fairly, yeah.
Another audience member asked, has there been a drop in the goat population in your study areas, 14C and 13D?
No, goats are doing great. That's actually a great question. given unlimited time and unlimited budgets, I would love to quantify the effects that goats are having on sheep populations. There's been quite a bit of speculation that goats are actually competing with sheep and could be, I won't say, let's not say a cause, but let's say could be associated with the decline in sheep populations, or perhaps they're not hurting because of it. So, no, the goat numbers are actually up across the board in both study areas.
Next, how much does an average lamb weigh?
Almost identical to a human infant. A newborn lamb is 2.5 to 4 kilos. So, think human infant.
Do you mark a difference in weight?
Nothing. I haven't actually run the statistical analysis on that, and that's something I should have done. I kind of dropped that ball. So come back next year. Nothing really jumped out. I've seen some differences year to year in the 13D study area, which I think will probably show up once we do the hardcore statistical analyses. But in terms of the two study areas, not necessarily. We do see it in moose. We see it in caribou. So it's very possible that given enough data, we'll have something.
The next question from the audience was, what is the hunting pressure in 14C and 13D?
That was another reason we chose the 13D study area. Right as we initiated the project, that area went to a drawing hunt. it had been open access on a harvest ticket, and so anybody could go in and hunt it. It had been getting hit really, really hard. We instituted the draw with the 2008 hunting season. 14C has always been on a draw, although 2 years ago, the number of tags was substantially reduced. you know, we've seen a 30 to 50% decline across the board in South Central sheep populations. So we're well aware that there's a lot of issues that stem from that. But the last 13D. We were killing, as a population, we're taking probably 30 to 40 rams a year out of the 13D study area, or the 13 game management unit 13D as a whole. And now with the drawing hunts, we're down in the 10 to 15 annually across the unit. And 14C had historically harvested about 30 rams a year from just 14C alone. In the last 2 years, it's been right around 10 to 12 animals. So it's substantially reduced.
Are there any nutritional or physiological factors that could affect population rates of Dall sheep?
There's a whole suite of nutritional players that could be affecting, that could be having an effect at some level. Trace minerals for sure. you know, there's been some really elegant work done on caribou forage, looking at seasonal differences based on whether a summer was hot and dry or cool and wet, and actually the nutritional content of the forage varies substantially just year to year. Even within study areas. So yeah, without a doubt. When we conceived this project, we didn't have any idea about sheep in South Central. I mean, we'd had, I think, literally six collars on sheep in 50 years south of the Alaska Range. And there were some collars that were deployed in Eklutna and Peters Creek, and looking at some movement patterns and stuff, and maybe a couple in Wrangell St. Elias National Park, but literally the number of sheep collared was in the single digits. So we knew nothing. And it was intended to give us a real broad scope look and then kind of refine and go from there.
Another audience member asked, is there any information on what's happening with Dall sheep in the Wrangell Mountains?
No. Park Services, We've got some census data from the Wrangells and the Kenai's. We can talk about it at length. I'd be happy to.
Just number of trends.
Everything south of the range is not doing well. You know, it's nuanced. Some areas are far, far worse than others. But I'm pretty confident in saying that it sucks. it's been declining since the 89, 90, 91 winters, and the only bright spot is that we're starting to see potentially some tabling out and maybe some slight population increases in both in 14C and 13D. The bigger question in my mind is why haven't we seen the real cyclic rebound? You know, and that's something that I'd like to be able to address as things take shape. But now the Kenai's are probably in worse shape than 13D or 14C. So,
when you're measuring fat and nutrition, are you doing that before winter?
All before winter?
No, we haven't.
Yeah. Regaining health.
Yeah, that's one of the next steps. and really, what we need to do for that is to be able to before we start doing that, we should be able to actually measure total body fat. Not sure if you're familiar with it, but there's actually a way to do that in moose. You can actually measure the amount of fat on a moose's rump with an ultrasound machine, measure that depth, and then calculate from that to total body fat. So we would need, in order to make the most use out of that handling, we'd need to have an index like that validated. And I've started that work, and we haven't had a chance to wrap it up. But it's the ball's rolling in that direction.
Are you collecting samples from successful hunters?
No, more actually dead animals and saving them for a whole body grind, and basically hold the sheep up by its hind legs, run it through a really, really big grinder, and don't laugh, they make them. and then determining total body fat and protein and mineral levels from, but the hang up there is being able to correlate those numbers to what you get on the real, on the live animal. So, go ahead.
Another audience member asked, how far down do you study? And why do you think goats are doing better than sheep?
Kenai's, down just a little bit south of Tustamina. Probably snowfall. One of the hypotheses that we're kicking around right now with respect to sheep and goats is that goats are more tolerant of deep snow. They seem to store fat a little bit differently, and their overwinter strategy might be to just kind of hunker and metabolize rather than actively forage. So one of the suppositions is that goats are a little bit more successful at weathering heavy snow and wet conditions than sheep are. You know, sheep are very superbly adapted to cold and dry. They're amazingly well insulated, but warm and wet, at least by Alaska standards, doesn't do sheep a lot of good. I suspect the difference in the delineation in sheep range, actually if you look at the southern end of 14C right along the arm, you know, as you go from basically you go from Bird Point, Windy Point to Girdwood, there's a point in there you just don't see sheep. And I suspect that that's very directly related to snowfall.
Next, an audience member asked, do Dall sheep leave their calves?
I suspect they do, given what we see when we approach. But they can also be really, really good mothers. We've seen some pretty neat things over the years. I didn't get to see it. I was on another project. But we had a report this year. I think, were you in the helicopter? Okay, Kyle, this is Kyle Smith here in the front row. Kyle's one of our techs, and he's instrumental in this project. He was on the ground, helicopter pilot was in the air, and we actually observed a ewe, a female, body blocking a golden eagle. The eagle was on short final to take out the lamb at speed, was in a power dive, and the ewe stepped in front of the lamb, and the eagle hit the ewe in its kind of midsection, landed on the ground, and the way the helicopter pilot told the story was kind of bounced off and shook itself and looked around and was like, whoa, and then just flew off. So, you know, when we approach them, yeah, they blow out, and they'll kind of watch. So I suspect in a case where a bear or a wolf was approaching the ewe, her instinct is going to be to run. But in a mid-sized predation situation like potentially an eagle, they might choose differently. Interestingly enough, if you look at the amount of energy, there's actually a fairly good reason for doing it that way. If you look at the amount of energy a female animal has to expend carrying a fetus in the uterus to birth, and compare that to the amount of energy she has to spend nursing and feeding that animal milk through the course of the summer, the energy is much, much lower to carry it to term than it is to feed it. So if she loses it early on in pregnancy, If a bear or a wolf approaches, she's making a far better energetic bet to just run, lose that animal early in life, and know that she can recoup that energy and breed the next year. Whereas in a case where that young one is lost late in the winter, she might have spent so much energy that she wouldn't be able to do it.
Do they give birth year after year?
That's one of the things I'm trying to get at. And that'll tell us volumes about whether this is a nutritional situation. We've seen that in moose in some really nutritionally limited moose populations. The reproductive pause is a strategy that they'll use just to regain. So once I start looking at individual histories, well, that'll pop right out.
The last question from the audience was, are there Dall sheep twins?
Rarely, if ever. It's said that they never twin, and I'm done saying never. In my career, I've been bitten a couple of times, but it has not been reported. They do babysit. A lot of times a ewe will leave a lamb with another and take off and go forage and come back, and I suspect that some of the reports of twins might be a situation like that. And we've got I've seen it happen with known collared ewes and known collared lambs where one will just stash a lamb with another ewe and take off and come back a few hours later. So.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Alaska Department of Fish and Game research biologist Dr. Tom Lohuis. He responded to questions from the audience following his talk on Dall Sheep on the Decline, Understanding Sheep Population Dynamics. It was recorded at the Wildlife Wednesday lecture series hosted by the Alaska Zoo on January 9, 2013. Dr. Lohuis shared two videos of his team capturing Dall Sheep in the Chugach. You can watch both videos at alaskapublic.org. Coming up next week, you might remember Dr. Gabor Mate, who was a guest on KSKA's Line 1 Your Health Connection back in January. Next week on Addressing Alaskans, listen to his talk on addiction, from heroin to workaholism, recorded at the Alaska Health Summit. And don't forget, Addressing Alaskans is moving to Tuesdays in a couple weeks. Starting February 19th, listen to Addressing Alaskans at the same time, 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. on Tuesday. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.